morning and welcome. I'm delighted to welcome you to our first one-day seminar for General Insurance for 2015, The Changing Face of GI. And the idea for this seminar really arose from the feedback that we had from last year's GI seminar around the sorts of topics that people wanted to hear more about. It's also the first one-day event that we've held or hosted at the Institute, thanks to the larger facilities that we've got in the new premises, so we're sort of a bit of a test case. Now, of course, as I've discovered, the most important job as president is to let you know where the toilets are, and I'm expecting by the time I finish this year, I'll know where the toilets are in every major hotel in Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide, Brisbane and Perth. So they're very well marked, up through the door at the back and a bit to your, and then go left. I'm also told that one of the meeting rooms, if you go back through the door that you came in, one of the meeting rooms has been set aside as a cloakroom. So if you want to put your coats and bags in there so you're not carrying them around, then please feel free to do so. Now, also on behalf of the Institute, I would like to acknowledge and thank our sponsors, Finity Consulting, who is sponsoring the session after, stop laughing, Tim, the session after lunch on data analytics. So thanks, me. And Taylor Fry, who's the sponsor of the session just before lunch on technological change. And obviously, sponsorship of our event is very much appreciated by the Institute. If you are a tweeter, you can follow the seminar on Twitter and keep up to date with what's happening using at actuariesinst and the hashtag GI seminar. Now we'll move straight on to the first session, which is on the general insurance landscape and outlook, which is being chaired by Tim Clark. Tim is the current convener of the Institute's General Insurance Practice Committee. And he's also the EGM Risk and Performance at for personal insurance at IAG. And in that role, his responsibilities include ensuring that personal insurance achieves its targets within risk appetite through provision of financial and risk information, insight and challenge. But all you actually need to know about Tim is that his favourite book is Captain Corelli's Mandolin. His favourite film is Diva, and his favourite piece of music is Jupiter. And according to Tim, you can tell everything about somebody just from those three pieces of information. And I won't tell you what he thinks of me. So I'll ask Tim to come up. Thank you.
Thanks, yourself for that. It's just a little story. A long time ago, I thought I didn't have time to actually read everything in the library, hear every piece of music, look at every movie. So I came up with this strategy of asking people I quite respected what were their favourite movies, favourite books, favourite pieces of music, and that was my filter strategy. But it somewhat backfired because some people I quite respected, they came up with movies that were just atrocious, books that were boring as anything. And so it's kind of backfired, so you've got to be careful about how you implement change. And I think That's one of the themes of today. It's a pretty exciting time to be in the general insurance space and to be an actuary. And today we're really going to have a forward-looking view of what the industry, what might be in the industry in the future, what roles us as actuaries might play, and how it's going to develop and what things we're going to have to innovate to be part of the future. Because there's so much change happening and we have to be part of it. And as actuaries, our common skill sets of modelling and understanding how things might change in the future, we're tracking a bit slower than some others. So I think we have to keep that in mind when we're working. Even with my limited cognitive abilities, in the short term, what I can see is the trend in technological change is just increasing exponentially. The costs of production are just becoming cheaper and cheaper for things to build, so therefore cognitive services as opposed to physical services obviously changing in a big way. The availability and the ways we're using data are changing just exponentially as well. Driverless cars and anti-crash systems, mobile and home devices are all connected to the internet, giving us different ways of measuring, protecting, servicing the population and controlling things. 3D printing, we're going to be able to print things at the end of a phone line now. So that means the way factories are set up and the way you can just deliver unique and individual products to people. How are we going to ensure them? It's pretty exciting times if you think about it. Or is it? Or should we be a bit scared? And I was reading The Economist recently, and it opened, there was an article about artificial intelligence, and they opened up with quotes from Stephen Hawking, Bill Gates, and Elon Musk, who's an entrepreneur and delivers spaceships and solar-powered stuff. And it kind of summed up, the opening line was Stephen Hawking, the development of full artificial intelligence could spell the end of the human race. Now, these guys aren't technological morons, are they? They're people who are heavily involved in this development, and yet they're scared. So let's think about that. You can be excited, you can be scared, but whatever we think now, and whatever we're worried about, change is going to come, and you get on it, or you get rolled over by it. So that's what we're talking about today. Now, if I can just flicker. Where'd you put the flicker, Lisa? Okay. So today, we've got four sessions. So the first is the general insurance landscape and the outlook, followed up by technological change and its impact on the general insurance industry, the data analytics, and we'll explore deep in that, and then the changing role of actuaries. So pretty broad and wonderful session we've got going on. So first of all, the general insurance industry and the current position, we have three great presenters, and I'll lead that session, and then we'll follow up with a panel session. But before we start, the housekeeping, apart from the toilets, Estelle forgot to tell you, mobile phones off, or there's a $10 charge to your favourite charity. This is a new institute rule I've just implemented. So the general insurance industry landscape, this focuses on the market's current state and the changes going on, how increased globalisation, customer-first marketing and innovation in product strategies are changing the way we've got to do business. We'll explore the current landscape and look forward into how it might change. The session will be 15 minutes, presentation from each of the three presenters. We have John Durham from Swiss Re, we have Kevin Gomes from Taylor Fry, and Mark Kimberley from the legal firm HWL. Your input is heavily encouraged. What we're going to do is have each of the speakers come up and do the presentation, and then we'll sit down and have a panel session after that. So record the questions that you have as you go through. It's probably better just to take them all there. We've got about 40 minutes at the end of the presentations to take us through. So first of all, I'd like to invite up John, Mark and Kevin to the stage. But John, who's going to speak first to us, he's the appointed actuary at Swiss Re for the Australian property and casualty entities. And he also leads the corporate actuarial team there. And Estelle's recently just done a survey on his favourite piece of music, his favourite book, and favourite movie. So The Skeptical Essay is his favourite piece of writing by Bertrand Russell. Casablanca, as you all know from, is his favourite movie. And Land of Hope and Glory is his favourite piece of music. So to the stage with that observation, John Durham.
Thanks, Lisa, and thank you, Tim, for those very kind words of introduction. And I hope you still like me, despite knowing what's my favourite book, what's my favourite movie, and what's my favourite piece of music. Tim, thank you very much indeed for your kind introduction. Actually, you were a bit kinder than my colleague Rob Warren, who's an actuary who has joined us quite recently at Swiss Re. He started off by saying that he couldn't imagine anyone more perfect than me to present on the topic of the changing face of general insurance. Now, that sounds nice. And then he added, because I think, John, your face has changed more than anyone else's. So, thanks very much, Rob. But thanks, Tim, for your kinder words. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to do something perhaps a little unusual, you might think, because what I really want to do is start with a somewhat retrospective take on the way in which we can estimate future changes in the general insurance industry. Now, we're all actuaries here, and I think everybody would be familiar with that analogy of an insurance company as a car. Now, the car is being steered by the chief executive of the insurance company, but he's getting some help from some of his colleagues. So he's being assisted by his marketing manager, who has his foot full on the accelerator, by his underwriting and claims manager, she has her foot firmly on the brake. And meanwhile, the car is being steered by the actuary, who's calling out instructions to the chief executive as to how to steer the car, but looking only in the rearview mirror. Now, following on from that analogy, and we often get accused as a profession of being a profession that looks in the rearview mirror. So picking up on that, that's exactly where I would like to start today. Of course, we're going to get into all sorts of interesting discussions about all the things that we can look at and see that are changing and going to change over the course of our careers. But I'd like to start by saying, well, look, what can we learn by looking backwards? To do this, I'm going to use the STEEP acronym. Now, in the old days, I think this was called PEST, for political, economic, social, and technological. But a couple of years ago, five PwC actuaries did a paper for one of the Institute seminars, and they added the word environmental. And that's a fair observation, I think, that environmental considerations are important today. So we added the E, and that made the acronym STEEP. And this was how they looked at that acronym, to use that to shed light on developments in the profession. So they're saying we need to look at what's changed socially, what's changed technologically, economically, environmentally, and politically. And I've taken this slide from those five authors. So it was Tony Bean and four collaborators, Sylvia Wong and three others from PwC, presented to an Institute seminar 3 years ago in 2012. But first of all, I'm going to talk to some of the social changes, what's happened to the people in the general insurance industry, and in particular, what's happened to the role that general insurance actuaries have played in the general insurance industry. And I'm going to take just the perspective of looking back over my career and my lifetime, just to see what's changed, that what we can see in our past. But before I do that, before I flick over to the next slide and start to look at some of the social changes, I'd like to start a little competition. The Institute, by tradition, very kindly gives each of its presenters a bottle of wine to thank them for their presentations. And I'm going to have a short 60-second competition, and I'm prepared to donate my bottle of wine to whoever can tell me, according to the Actuaries Institute records, how many fellows of the Institute of Actuaries were working for general insurers in 1981? How many fellows were working for general insurers in 1981, according to Actuaries Institute records? Okay, hands up.
13.
Elaine? Four from Mark. Three from Warwick.
Zero.
More guesses? Oh, there's a bottle of wine still going. No one's got it yet. Two? Five. More guesses?
One.
More. Only one per customer, Warwick. More guesses? Come on, more guesses. No one still nailed it. Seven. Well, we seven from Gay. 15. 20. 25. 11. 30.
12.
All right, one last guess.
Pie,
was it? Pie. Pie, right, no. All right, well, I think you've done extraordinarily well, because you've all been in a reasonable ballpark, and Andrew and Gay will have to toss up to decide who gets the bottle of wine, because I think Andrew said five and Gay said seven. The correct answer is six. So, look, I think you've done really well, because if we think back to 1981, things were extraordinarily different then. So look, insurance is a social good. It's been around since at least 1426. Somebody who knows something about it will probably tell me that the ancient Egyptians were doing it like thousands of years before that. But marine business was being written in London in 1426. It's a social good because it reduces the risk of a business enterprise, reduces the cost of capital, and that means that commerce can function much more efficiently with an active and sound insurance industry. So it's in the interest of the public and insurers and regulators that insurance be soundly priced and soundly reserved. Now, actuarial involvement in the insurance industry is much more recent than 1426. And as most of our guesses were pretty much tuned in, there was only a handful of pioneers if you go back to the 60s and 70s. And people like Roger Sawkins, Trevor Matthews, Richard Cumston, John Trowbridge, and above all, Greg Taylor, have made absolutely extraordinary contributions to the development of actuarial science that underlies general insurance. Only six fellows worked for general insurers in 1981, only nine by 1990. But by 1992, there were 31 fellows of the Institute of Actuaries of Australia, that was 4% of the total, who identified themselves as working in general insurance. Now, that's not quite the same as the two previous, the figures of 6 and 9, because they were people actually working in general insurance companies, but the 31 could have been working in, say, consulting firms or in government, but just with general insurance as their primary practice area. But things have taken off extraordinarily since then. Obviously, through the 90s, there was a rapid growth of actuarial participation in the general insurance industry. It became a statutory requirement in 2001 for an insurer to appoint an actuary to value its liabilities. That was reflecting what was already happening by the late 90s, where just about all companies were probably retaining the services of an actuary to value their liabilities anyway. And by the 2014 Year in Review publication, 24.7% of all members of the actuarial profession in Australia were working in general insurance. Now, that publication didn't give a breakdown of fellows, but if we just assume that that is across the board, that 24.7%, that would mean about 500 fellows today are working in general insurance. A far cry from the six or nine that we're talking about from 1981 or 1990. So I think it's interesting to ask, well, what accounted for that extraordinary growth of involvement of actuaries in the industry? And Chris Latham, who had a long career at PwC, I think he's just retired recently, Andrew, thank you. In 1991, he wrote the four reasons why he thought that actuaries had such a profound influence and a rapid growth in their involvement. So firstly, he said that practitioners had made huge progress in rationalising the methods and approaches that they developed. So they developed a whole plethora of approaches to valuing outstanding liabilities, and they progressed towards rationalising those methods. The 1988 Institute of Actuaries Practice Note on Outstanding Claims helped to gain acceptance from the industry. The regular biennial forums have often been highlighted as a means by which actuaries start to have an influence on non-actuaries who work inside the industry. And finally, the formal submissions made by the General Insurance Committee, that would now have been renamed the General Insurance Practice Committee, and continuous proselytising by key individuals in all possible circumstances have contributed to the education process. Technology is perhaps an area where also change has been absolutely extraordinary over my lifetime. My school years were 1962 to 1974, and in those years, if you wanted to multiply 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 by 6, 7, 8, 9, there were three ways you did it. The first way was you wrote it out longhand, 1, 2, 3, 4 times 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I'm not even sure if, but, you know, my younger actuarial colleagues would I guess you still know how to do it, but if you don't, you can come to me afterwards and I'll explain that. if that was too long-winded, well, you used a slide rule. The problem with a slide rule was it only gave you an approximation. Or failing that, you used log tables. And through my school years, you had this orange book of 40 pages of Cain Levy log tables. So you effectively look at the log of 1, 2, 3, 4, and then the log of 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and you added those, and then you looked up the anti-log, and that was how you did it, because calculators went around. Calculators came in my school years, you can see from the graphic here that some of the first commercial or transistor desktop calculators, I think they date back to the late 60s or very early 70s. But what I find the most astonishing single piece of information on the slide is that those calculators, which are completely ridiculously trivial and antique by comparison with what we've got now, at the time that the price you paid for those calculators was comparable to the price you paid for a family car. And all sorts of other technological changes have happened over the course of my career as well. The graphic there is a photo of me on one of the photo of me on one of the early mobile telephones. okay, no, it's not me. But the early mobile telephones were extraordinarily bulky. I don't remember them being quite as big as it is in the picture, but they were very bulky. They weighed about half a kilo. So compare that to the weight of the iPhones and the Samsung smartphones that we get these days. Computers, of course, have made an absolutely extraordinary contribution and changed completely the way we work. Now, computers, when I was at school and you wanted to use a computer, what happened, and this was probably only in secondary school, you punched cards. We didn't punch the cards ourselves. We had to write in pencil on top of these cards, letter by letter. I can see one or two nodding faces, but don't nod too fast, or people will realise how long it is since you were at school. So we had to punch the cards, and then those punched cards were sent off to Monash University, because that was the place where the computer was, And when I started working about 1979, I mean, yes, we had a computer at the Government Actuary's Office in Canberra. It was this kind of massive, massive, massive thing that kind of occupied a whole room by itself. If anybody watches Mad Men, you know, the show about the advertising industry, it's set in the late 60s, and in about 1969 they took the decision to buy a computer, and that meant that about 30 of their people who occupied like one massive floor, they had to move because the computer was going to occupy the space where they previously worked, and that the computer that they had probably had around about the same memory or processing power as the average laptop that we work on these days. Mobile telephones were extraordinarily expensive as well, like 1987. So my career had started in 1980. I moved to Sydney, actually. I spent 7 years in the Government Entries Office and moved to Sydney. And 1987 was the first year for mobile telephones, and they cost $4,250 in 1987. So think about adding inflation for that. And, of course, the Internet. So the Internet, I forget the year when it was actually founded, but, of course, growth grew exponentially in the 1990s. So huge consequences for our work. For recreation and for retail, and I see also huge consequences, even huger consequences than we've already seen coming for fintech, that is the provision of financial services through technology. Email, of course. I mean, when I started, we didn't even have fax, and fax is sort of come and pretty much gone. Maybe the legal profession still use faxes, Mark, but no? Okay.
Swiss banks.
Okay, Swiss banks do. Pretty much come and gone because email is now the enormously widely accepted use of communication. Social media are going to have an enormous impact. 20 or 30 years ago, the idea of being able to make a phone call to someone and actually see their picture in real time at the other end of the telephone, if you'd said that's going to be possible, people would have been saying you've been, eating too much magic mushrooms or something or other, but now it's called Skype. Data transmission, the volumes are huge and extraordinary. Infraeconomics, I've just picked up on a few of the many extraordinary changes. the high inflation of the 1970s, oddly enough, helped gain acceptance for the role of actuaries in general insurance reserving. The reason was because before then, everybody did case estimate reserving. And when you had the 70s bout of inflation, the case estimates just got left way, way, way behind, whereas actuaries were a bit more able to foresee the impact of inflation on those on their historical triangles, do their projections, and come up with better reserves. The financial markets have opened extraordinarily in the 60s and 70s. And these days there are no regulatory barriers to entry, really, other than having to meet the prudential requirements. Central banks and monetary policy seem to have defeated the inflation dragon, at least for the time being. On the other hand, the extraordinarily low interest rates that we're seeing at the moment post-GFC, they do pose a problem for insurers and reinsurers because the rates are so low that poses challenges in being able to push the technical cost up in order to meet the new discounted cost of future claims. The easy cross-border flow of capital has meant the growth of tax havens and tax shelters. So particularly in the reinsurance industry, we see real centres of reinsurance capital in Bermuda and other tax havens. And alternative risk transfer has started to become a means, not so much in Australia yet, but in other areas where risk can be passed from insurer to reinsurer. E for environmental. The industry has come a long way in its thinking about the environment. That's been, of course, accompanied by huge scientific developments. So the International Panel for Climate Change produced its first assessment report only in 1990, and its fifth and most recent in 2014. So many corporates and many insurers, many reinsurers, set a high value on sustainability these days. So as I speak, I'm about to purchase solar panels to put on the roof of my house. My company is going to subsidise the cost of those solar panels by 50% as one of the many initiatives that my company has got to support sustainability and green enterprise. And I know that my reinsurer is not the only one. There are other reinsurers who are equally passionately committed to sustainability and green values, and other insurers as well make it clear from the way that they behave that they regard sustainability as extremely important. Huge catastrophes have affected us, and one of the outstanding and interesting questions is the extent to which weather changes will impact on the cost of insurance going forward. I think it's clear, it's very clear that they will, but the timing and the mode of implementation of those increased costs, we've still to see. When I talk about political, I'm not talking so much about party political, but about the regulatory interface between politics and the general insurance industry. And regulation has changed just as extraordinarily as the other aspects that I've been talking about. So I actually started my career in the Government Actuary's Office in 1979. And so just to give you an idea for the number of people who were involved in regulation at that time, the Government Actuary's Office, we had about 15 to 20 people. We were right next door to the Life Insurance Commissioner's Office. They had a few more. They would have had about 20 to 25. Now, the Insurance Commissioner had a few more again. They might have had 35 or 40. So, and the Government Actuary's Office has never been part of what is now APRA. So if you add up the Life Insurance Commissioner's people and the Insurance Commissioner's people, you'd probably get, 60 people devoted to the regulation of the life and general insurance industries. APRA today has 580 staff. Now, that's not completely a like-for-like comparison because APRA's added regulation of ADIs and superannuation funds, which weren't included in those two insurance commissioners in those days. But what I can tell you is that the volume of resources available to APRA has increased extraordinarily. In the old days, when I was in the Government Actuary's Office, when the insurance commissioner wanted to test out the reserves, the level of reserves held by some of the big insurance companies, it had to come knocking on the door of the government actuary to ask for some assistance in doing the triangulation exercises. And by comparison now, APRA has extraordinary resources, including many actuaries. I come from a prudential consultation with APRA colleagues last week, and I think there was 24 APRA colleagues were involved in this prudential consultation, and 10 were involved in the closing meeting, including, I might say, two very competent actuaries. At least that's what I was going to say, but I see David Jenkins is in the audience today, so I'm going to say two extremely competent actuaries. But clearly the volume of resources that APRA has at its disposal is like far in excess of what it used to have. And that matches, really, the increase in the volume of prudential standards. That's also changed extraordinarily, and on the right-hand side, that page, which is the General Insurance Prudential Standards, that is kind of permanently bookmarked. I should just keep it permanently open on my PC, and probably some of you do as well, because the number of times that we, in a normal course of our events, need to refer to APRA Prudential Standards is very large. And the detail of those standards is just absolutely extraordinary compared to what applied in the old days. Just to mention one thing, I'm not sure how many of us here would have been involved, say, with the computation of the asset risk charge. But if anybody has dealt with the asset risk charge, you'll know exactly what I mean about the detail and the complexity and the sophistication of the concepts. Insurance concentration risk charge is another one, which is just so extraordinarily different from anything we had before. And perhaps the simplest way to capture it is just to mention what the solvency standard was for the insurance industry. When I started out in the industry, it was 15% of net written premium or 20% of your outstanding claims provision. And that was it. We had it easier in those days. And LAGIC, ICAP and CPS 220 and the emphasis on risk and capital management has all increased extraordinarily, even in the last 15 years. Okay, so what's happened to the insurance sector in the context of all of those changes? Firstly, there's been significant rationalisation. So when I started out in the early 80s, I think we had about 200 direct insurers and about 50 reinsurers. By 2000, that was down to 131 direct insurers and 30 reinsurers. And today, in the context of the regulatory environment that we have today, 89 direct insurers and 8 authorised reinsurers. I think that rationalisation was a rational response to the growth of complexity in the environment and to economies of scale. I mentioned that we've got much more sophisticated, much more intrusive regulation, huge emphasis on risk management and governance. I suppose one of the big issues now, and one that the analysts really focus on, is growth. So they see Australia as being a mature market, and that they ask the question, okay, so where is the growth going to come from? Big data has been an enormous development and one with potential to make pricing much more granular. We're already seeing that happening in a variety of ways. I was amazed to read probably 6 months ago now that a group of actuaries from Quantium, who had sourced data from a number of different sources, some of it insurance data and some of it supermarket data, some of it, you know, bottle shop sales, and they were able to demonstrate that there was incredibly high statistical significance between the cost of insuring a motor car and whether people ate meat and potatoes, that meant you're a very low motor vehicle risk, or whether you eat pasta and rice and buy your petrol from service stations late at night and buy alcohol from the grog shops. So I could see the link between alcohol and the grog shops and high cost of motor vehicle insurance, but the aspects of diet were completely extraordinary. And so who knows where the analysis of data is going to take us in terms of pricing insurance business. GPS has meant a degree of granularity in pricing property risk that previously was not possible. We used to do postcode rating, and that was just about it. That has become much more granular now, and I live in fear and trepidation of the day when my house and contents insurer realises that, okay, I'm in Roseville postcode, which is 2069, but I back onto Lane Cove National Park, which is a flame zone. So I'm going to see my insurance premium increase one day, probably someday soon. And the emergence of challenger brands, of course, is a very important development in the insurance sector at the moment. Look, if I try and encapsulate some of my remarks in a quote, and I'll pick up on Bill Gates was one of Tim's three wise men. And Bill Gates said, we always overestimate the change that will happen in the next 2 years and underestimate the change that will occur in the next 10. Look, I think that's true. And looking back on my career and looking at some of the young actuaries in the room today who have got a full career in front of you, if we extrapolate that 10 to 30 or 40 years, I think the change that we're going to see, the change from the last 30 to 50 years has been mind-boggling. And I suggest that the longer-term changes, the 30 or 40 years changes, that they are largely unforeseeable. We can see many of the things that are going to have an impact over the next 2, 5, 10 years, but over the next 30 or 40 years, I think it's virtually impossible to predict what the industry is going to look like. The actuarial skill set is valuable, but we see that in some respects it's under threat, for example, from outsourcing. So my own small team of four has recently received approval for one additional full-time equivalent, but that full-time equivalent to be based in Bangalore. And when you look at the relative cost, I can absolutely understand why not just my company, but a lot of companies are looking to outsourcing. And also the potential replacement of what now are relatively manual tasks with automated approaches. I'd say that insurers and their service providers in this context, against this background, will need to adapt intelligently to changes in their environment. And that the industry and the profession will both need to keep learning and to focus on a continuous improvement mindset. And Mr. Chairman, on that note of continuous improvement, I think now would be pretty much the perfect time for you to hand over to the next speaker, Kevin Gomes.
Thanks very much, John, and I'd encourage you to all kind of keep your questions until the panel session. Just think about John's career. We could squeeze it into sort of 10 years now, so you didn't need to work all those extra years. It's a waste of time in hindsight. But actually, my bottle of wine is going to go to the actuaries in the room who replace the Cumstons, the Taylors, the Matthews, who at my retirement speech in 15 years' time have made the contribution that those guys made to the actuaries 10, 20, 30 years ago. So think about that, because it's up to us to kind of create our way in the future, and that's a bit what today's about. Now, I'd like to introduce Kevin Gomes, who works at Taylor Fry. He's been an actuary for 25 years, and they run together with one of the merchant banks we won't mention, a survey of the general insurance landscape, and provide a really insightful kind of overview of where the insurance industry is and what we might see in the next, 1 to 5 years is kind of the time horizon we look at there. Just so you can compare him to John and use my kind of filtering strategy, his favourite book's The Prince by Machiavelli. Following on from that, his favourite movie, similar vein, is The Godfather. So do you like The Godfather or Casablanca? And his favourite piece of music, Bohemian Rhapsody. So, Kevin, to the stage. Thank you.
Thanks, Stephen. I'll start with a kind of bit of housekeeping or a word of warning for the future panellists. that have to come in for the rest of the day. If you've got any really tall people, make sure you sit them over here and not over there. John, if you were in that seat over there, you'd be blocking half. Sorry, that's my thing.
That joke won't have a mark.
Okay, now, as Tim said, a lot of the material that I'm presenting today really, it is material that we've jointly produced with an unnamed merchant bank, but it is important I do attribute Siddharth Paramaswaran from this unnamed merchant bank, JP Morgan. So, and indeed, some of the slides really have come directly from Siddharth, so who was originally supposed to be here to present, but was a late withdrawal. So just as an outline of what I'll be talking about, so I'll start with a few slides really talking about the economic outlook, and then go on to the weather outlook, the implications for insurers of that weather outlook, and in particular the likely cat experience that we see happening. Some key challenges facing insurers, and these are challenges nominated by insurers themselves that we surveyed. And then finish off just with a snapshot of some key classes of business. Okay, so in terms of the economic climate, well, it's fair to say the economic climate is challenging for insurers with low growth prospects and depressed investment returns. So unemployment is expected to continue to rise, and consensus forecasts are for low GDP growth following the collapse in commodity prices. Interest rates aren't expected to rise anytime soon. As John alluded to, the low interest rate environment is posing challenges for insurers. And there are some pockets of growth still there, and in particular, there is still opportunities for export growth, particularly for to pick up as the Australian dollar continues to weaken. But really, we feel this is unlikely to provide much relief to Australian domestic insurers, whose prospects are driven more by the domestic sectors of the economy. So, investment yields. The low inflation might be seen as a good thing by some, but really it's also, it keeps claim costs under control, but it really does make it harder to justify growth in premiums for insurers. The currency has been weak, and that may ultimately give rise to inflationary pressures for some class of business who rely on overseas componentry, such as domestic motor. But the cost of part didn't really seem to benefit greatly when the A-dollar appreciated. So maybe this link might be a little bit more tenuous than is sometimes thought. So investment yields are at all-time lows for both government and commercial bonds, and the lack of investment returns is really hurting the long-tailed underwriters of the long-tail class of business, so CTP, workers' comp, public liability, PI and D&O. Just to illustrate the impact of the low yields, so during 2014 there was a contraction of bond yields of around about 0.85%, and if we just worked with an assumed liability duration for the industry of 2 years, so that 0.85% contraction was responsible for a 1.7% contraction in the insurance margins. And to put that into context, the insurance margins for the industry in 2014 were around about 19%. So it's very material, 1.7% reduction off that 19% margin just from the yields. So on to the weather. And so the Southern Oscillation Indicators, which is really our measure for El Nino or La Nina, so that those indicators have shown a steady trend towards El Nino levels since the start of the year. So El Nino is often associated with below average winter and spring rainfall over eastern Australia and above average daytime temperatures over the southern half of the country. However, the current June to July outlook suggests that Australia is likely to be wetter than average because there's warmer than average Indian Ocean dominating the outlook. But El Nino is expected to become the dominant influence on the climate during the second half of the year. So what does this mean? Well, the main characteristics of El Nino are more heat waves and consequently an increased bushfire risk. We should see fewer tropical cyclones, a longer frost risk season, and reduced chance of widespread floods. The correlation between the Southern Oscillation Index and the industry cap costs is certainly quite strong. So you can see the chart just to the left, which shows the two overlaid over one another, and certainly whilst there's a lot of volatility there, they tend to move together broadly. And the table to the right illustrates what the average cap costs for the Australian industry are, excluding earthquake costs, but what the average cap costs are more for storm-related caps during La Nina, neutral, and El Nino years. And you can see that during El Nino years, it's much more favourable than La Nina. So we've got just south of $0.6 billion during the El Nino years. La Nina is, by contrast, is over $3 billion average. So that's based on long-term ICA data. So now we go on to a few issues that have been nominated by insurers as some of the key issues they're grappling with. And one of them was raised already by John, which is, where is the growth coming from? There's a challenging growth outlook for insurers. So what does the APRA data show? So the APRA data shows that there's very low growth rates in the latter half of 2014, which are at almost the lowest levels for 20 years. So just put this into action. You can see that red line going down there. That's the GWP growth in the industry, and that's dipped down. This chart actually finishes in third quarter 2014. Fourth quarter 2014 was another bad period in terms of a negative growth or a decrease in GWP levels for the industry. But there was a bounce back in the first quarter of 2015. So really, at the levels that it's been at just in the last part of 2014, it is almost at the lowest level within that long-term period that is shown on that chart. And certainly that's creating challenges for insurers. First quarter of 2015 did show signs of a bounce back, and so that was around about 2% growth. It's not shown on the chart, but it's about 2% growth over the corresponding quarter in 2014. So that looks quite healthy. That compares to a decrease of 1.1% in fourth quarter 2014. The components of that slight bounce back, there was some growth in the personal lines GWP, so that was up by about 3%. Motor, within that personal lines, motor was up 3%, home by 2.8%. CTP up by 3.5. Commercial was only a more modest increase of 1.3%. Within commercial, I mean, the fire and ISR was down 3.2% in that first quarter of 2015, coming off a very poor fourth quarter in 2014 of a reduction in 12.5% in fire and ISR. So I'll talk a bit more about that later, and really the picture that we're seeing on the commercial lines is quite grim. I mean, that the 3.2% reduction coming off 12.5, I mean, the pleasing thing about that is at least it's a bit of a bounce back. I mean, if you want to look for the silver lining, it probably indicates that there is a little bit more rationality coming in to that market, but there's a lot of capacity that's been driving those reductions. So the graphic to the right shows the growth rates by class of business over a 20-year time period. So the average growth rate for the industry as a whole has been around about 6.3% over that time period. These are nominal growth rates. 6.6% has been the growth rate in the economy over that time period, the nominal growth rate. So they've been fairly close, but there has been a gap. So insurance is a sub-economic growth class of business. The interesting thing when you look at it by class of business is how much variation there is. So keep in mind, even a 1% difference in growth rate by class of business when compounded over a long time period, like 20 years, translates to a massive difference over the long term. So the class of business that have had the highest growth in premium over that time period, we've seen PI and home are the two classes which have had growth rates in excess of 8%. So they've been reasonably healthy. And at the other end of the scale, we've had the motor, so domestic and commercial motor and workers' comp have sub 6% growth rates. So they're well below economic growth, those classes. Probably in a way not surprising that these classes have had lower growth. I think they're the classes that have benefited the most from frequency improvements. So improved car design, road safety, so that's contributed to the reductions in the motor vehicle costs. And workers' comp, of course, through the improved occupational health safety. So we've seen reductions in that. So I guess there is that link between, not surprisingly, between frequency and the growth that's coming through on the premium side. So given a lack of new insurance products, few signs of claim inflation, and low expectations for GDP growth and substantial competition, so our outlook really would be for premium growth to be very difficult for insurers in the immediate and medium term. So another issue which was nominated by insurers as being one that's creating challenges and opportunities, I guess, for them is the impact of technology. I won't go into this particular topic in a lot of detail because it is the subject really of a separate plenary session. I think it's the next plenary session. I just wanted to give an overview for some of the reasons why this is nominated by insurers as a key issue that they have to deal with. It'd be fair to say the impact of technology is pervasive. It affects all aspects of insurance, from products and pricing through distribution, claims, and risk management. Just to give you an idea of some of the factors at play here. So the use of data analytics, we'll hear some more about that, of course, later today. So the use of that by insurers has led to substantially improved pricing structures and use of rating factors, particularly for personal lines. There's evidence that new entrants to the market are successfully poaching profitable customers from existing players, particularly over the last few years. We've seen evidence of that happening and possibly their use of analytics and sophisticated rating structures is assisting with that. So technological changes increase the risks associated with computer hacking and privacy breaches for companies. So it raises cyber insurance as a possible growth area, and certainly whilst that is as a product line is yet to take off, we expect this will happen in time as companies start to experience losses from cyber threats. So we've seen new business models and products, transport network companies like Uber and home hosting companies like Airbnb. They're causing market disruptions and posing new risks for consumers and indeed for insurers. It's now blurring the lines between personal and commercial insurance risks. These changes really provide both opportunities and challenges for new insurance products to help consumers manage the risks. And telematics for car insurance, it's shown limited growth in Australia, but it has had more traction overseas. An interesting aside, we noticed that there was a British insurer who started to offer discounts on pet insurance for if you've got a telematics device fitted to the collar of the pet. So I guess, you know, they figure that probably allows them to monitor whether the owners have been walking their pets enough and, you know, maybe locate the lost pets. So it's an interesting Okay. And the last issue that we just talked about, which an issue faced by insurers, and nominated by insurers as a key one for them, is alternative capital. So favourable CAT experience, particularly since 2011, has really led to a build-up of capital for reinsurers. And additional capacity has entered the market from both traditional reinsurance and also alternative reinsurance capital, such as, and talking about things such as cat bonds and collateralized reinsurance over here. So this, the chart that we have here shows the growth in traditional reinsurance capital as well as alternative capital, and the little bits up the top are the alternative capital. Still looks pretty small, admittedly, compared to the traditional reinsurance capital, but it's growing. It's growing as a percentage. So if you did the sums here, it's grown from about 5% up to about 11% of the total reinsurance capacity, and the signs are that it will continue to grow at least in the immediate outlook at a faster rate than traditional reinsurance. So who's putting up this alternative capital? It's really been put up by capital markets and investors, and North American pension funds feature quite strongly as a provider of the alternative capital. And really for them, the alternative capital, it might look big to us in the context of insurance or reinsurance, but it's a pretty small percentage of their funds invested. The additional yield on the alternative capital instruments appears particularly attractive at the current time to these investors, because we're in a very low yield environment, so if they can earn an extra 3 or 4% by taking on some insurance risk, then it will look very attractive to them given how low the bond yields are. And the other thing that attracts these investors is they perceive it as the insurance risk as having a very low correlation with the economic and credit risks that they're taking on through the bonds. So and indeed through equity. So that low correlation also looks very attractive to them. But it is worth noting, because when you sort of do the crystal ball gazing about alternative capital and how far it should go, I think it needs to be acknowledged that alternative capital is at a fundamental disadvantage to traditional reinsurer capital, in the sense that alternative capital tends to be put out in support of a specific risk, whereas traditional reinsurers will put their capital in, they'll be backing a whole portfolio of risks with it. So they've got the benefit of diversification that alternative capital doesn't have. And when you think that through, you think, how did it even get to this stage where alternative capital has enjoyed this growth, being at that's such a fundamental disadvantage? I think it really just is a case of funds looking for a place to invest that's caused the growth. So the influx of supply to alternative capital continues to lead to falls in the cost of that capital. So what this chart shows you is from 2000 to 2014, how the pricing spreads on cat bonds being one type of alternative capital. So how the pricing spreads have shifted over time. So what is a pricing spread? The pricing spread is the extra yield that is given to the investor in the cat bond in return for taking on an amount of insurance risk. And that expected loss is the measure of the insurance risk, and that's the yield that they get in return for it. So you can see in the year 2000, a cat bond issuer would have received around about 7% pricing spread for taking on a cat bond with 1.5% expected loss. And if we converted that into a loss ratio, to put it into our sort of insurance lingo, then the 1.5 over 7 translates into about a 20% loss ratio for that cover. So not great pricing, really. If you're someone looking to place risk in there and someone's only providing you cover but wanting 20% loss ratio, it's not that price competitive. But let's switch to 2014 and see what's happened. So that same cat bond investor taking on 1.5% expected loss. This time is only getting around 4% as their pricing spread in return. So if we convert that into a loss ratio just by taking the 1.5 over 4, we're probably looking at about 35% loss ratio now in 2014. That 35% might not sound that great still, but keep in mind these are competing with high layer aggregate excess of loss type covers on very large events. So it's probably not that uncompetitive anymore. So really this improved pricing on the cat bonds is starting to put more and more pressure on the traditional reinsurance market. And in terms of what's happened here in Australia, we haven't really seen that much use of alternative capital by insurers or reinsurers here within on Australian risks. But Australia certainly isn't immune to the impacts of alternative capital. So really the capacity that's coming through the alternative capital has really put price pressure on traditional reinsurance, and so we've seen reductions in the rates over recent years. And it started on the property market, but really it's spilling over into the casualty lines as well. Okay, the next few slides just give you a snapshot of just some select classes of the business and what's happening within those class of business, and it covers just the immediate past and I'll just make some comments on the immediate future. There's a lot of detail in this slide, so I'll probably just draw your attention to the highlights. So we start with home insurance, which I think is a key class business because it has provided really the backbone of growth for the industry. I mean, it's had double-digit rate increases for quite a few years, but really there's signs of that slowing down now. So during 2014, we saw home grow by 4%. I mean, it's still reasonably healthy, but that's come off a very large growth in the previous year. And indeed, if this chart went back even further, you'd see that there was really 3 or 4 years of double-digit rate increases for home insurance, probably coming off the 2011 cats. And so really, there was a pushing up of rates on home. And really, that's put the industry currently at quite profitable levels, home. So it's probably reasonable to expect that the rate increases will dry up now as competition starts to increase. Claims inflation it increased slightly from 3 to 5, but still okay. And overall, the profitability for home, it improved substantially from 89% combined ratio in FY 2013, 79% in 2014, driven by a reduction in both the loss and expense ratios, as well as a reduction in reinsurance rates. The new entrants coming to the market in home will put some pressure, though, on the existing players to hold market share. On motor, really the premium rates for motor stayed quite level over, so you won't even see them because they're 0% change during 2014. We expect premium rates probably to decrease slightly during 2015 in motor. So motor's benefited from low claims inflation, increases in excess and deductibles leading to lower claims costs, lack of weather-related claims, but there has been high level of competition within motor with some of the new entrants that have come into the market in recent years. So there were higher expense ratios during 2014 and that increased the combined ratio slightly up to 93%, up from 91% in 2013. But claims inflation has remained low. As previously mentioned, the falling currency does put some pressure, possible inflationary pressure on motors. So we'll see how that plays out. Claim frequency has been pretty flat and it's been growing. It's been showing a reduction over a long period of time. as previously mentioned. Okay, so very quickly, commercial property. Really, the picture hasn't been that rosy on commercial property or fire and ISR. The competition has been intense over recent years. There's been significant capacity increases in both the direct and reinsurance markets. Premium rates reduced by 12% in 2014, after 2% reduction in 2013. So the rate reductions have been driven at the corporate and middle market segments, so the larger risk segments. Excess capacity and price pressure from brokers are the greatest in those segments. Benign cat experience has really probably contributed as well to the reduction in rates. So in spite of the rate reductions, the profitability did improve slightly during 2014. So the combined ratio was 87%. The fall in expense ratio was a big contributor to that. So claim inflation is steady at 3%. There were reductions in reinsurance rates which benefited this class during 2014 of around 8%. And I'll just finish off very quickly with public and product liability, which the premium rates declined by 6% during 2014 following a 2% decline in 2013. Once again, the story is one of increased capacity, strong competition. The trend was seen across the SME, middle market and corporate market segments, and we expect premium rates in 2015 to continue to fall in these classes. There's been steady claim inflation and frequency, but a reduction in profitability in 2014, combined ratio of 91%. We expect combined ratios in 2015 to remain roughly level. And really, as well as the high level of competition in these classes, profitability has, of course, been affected by the very low investment return environment. Given the long-tail nature of this class, it's very relevant. That's just a few of classes of business, and I'll probably leave it there, but just to mention that I believe within your satchel inserts there is a publication which has really a lot of this material that you've already seen as well. So if you wanted to follow that up, you'll probably find that material in your inserts. That's about it. I'll hand over to
Thanks very much, Kevin, for that. The outlook doesn't look that inspiring, does it? I don't think I'll invite you to the next Tales conference. but it's a very valuable survey that Taylor Fry and JP Morgan do produce, and I think it's a bit of realism for us about where the industry sits and what our prospects going forward are. It's pretty challenging. And I think if you reflect on what Kevin was saying about the reinsurance industry, that model, business model, is fundamentally under threat. The way reinsurers used to diversify and build this package of risk diversification supported by its capital in a Swiss Re share or Munich Re share may not need to exist anymore. The Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett, even though he has to work there, it may not need to. That's the point. Warren Buffett, he diversifies naturally by buying railroads and a bit of Coca-Cola, and then he buys a bit of cat risk. So he does his diversification at a much bigger scale than a Swiss Re share or a Munich Re share that's just all about insurance risk packaged together. So their business model is challenging. But that's not it, because there's about 4,000 firms sitting in Silicon Valley having a go at the financial services sector, finding out ways, and these are smart guys thinking about ways that our business model will become redundant. And they'll come out with the Ubers, the Airbnbs, the whole way of trading. All these things are happening to us. And if we don't react, we'll be the Kodak, the Nokias. You've heard all the stories. So with that, I think we'll invite Mark up to give us a view on kind of the landscape and the outlook as well. Mark is an insurance partner at HWL Ellsworth. He's been 14 years acting in the insurance industry, advising national and international insurers. He was in Bermuda before he came to Australia. He's of Canadian heritage. He's been working on issues related to the corporate establishments and insurance authorisation, so the topics of regulation that John talked to will be there, portfolio transfers, regulatory matters, product design, wording, reinsurance, you've done it all. So without further ado, Mark, I'll invite you to the stage, please.
Thanks for having me today. I'll say one quick thing. John described Bermuda as a tax haven. Those of us who have worked in Bermuda, it's very important. It's a low-tax jurisdiction. It's part of the selling point of Bermuda, and it works better with some of the tax regulators. A few years ago, I was at one of these multi-day seminars where one of the keynote speakers was called a futurist, and I remember thinking at the time that has got to be the greatest job because you get to get up and speak, and there's absolutely no consequences to anything you say. So when they invited me today to talk about, the changing face, I thought, this is great. I'm not a lawyer. I get to be a futurist for an hour, or actually 10 minutes. And so I'm very pleased to kind of start talking about generally what I see in the market. A lot of what I'm going to be talking about is kind of things that I've just picked up through observation, where I've taken information, I'll attribute it as much as possible. So sometimes if you think that, hey, that's... I said that first, it probably was, and I've read it, and I'm just taking it today. The first thing I want to talk about in the industry is consolidation and the future behind consolidation. What we faced in the market is that and I'm not going to try and repeat what we've talked about, but, you know, there's low returns, low interest environment. And when you take a look at the management of insurance companies, reinsurers, everybody's trying to grow their business. And if you're not able to grow your business through increased revenue, increased premiums, you either reduce costs or you increase market share. So one of the reasons you're seeing a lot of consolidation in the worldwide reinsurance market, we've had XL Catlin, RenRe, Platinum. We've had Partner Re and Axis. Well, Partner Re just announced that they're going to go with Axis, and we'll see how that goes ahead, because I'm sure that there will probably be some litigation from XOR over that. But there's locally, there's been consolidation with TIO, Caledon, West Farmers. Acid Insure is still potentially out there on the market. We've had Ironshore, who was acquired by Fosun. And if you noticed it a few weeks ago, Catherine Simmons, who's the CEO of Ironshore here, said one of the great things about buying Fosun coming in is they now have capital to go out and acquire in the market. And as I said, the driver behind this is to get market share. And once there's a chain reaction behind all this consolidation, the chain reaction is that when an insurer consolidates with another insurer, it reduces the amount of customers for reinsurers. So by reducing the amount of customers for reinsurers, hence there's less market share, and you get consolidation in the reinsurance market, which then you get consolidation amongst the reinsurance brokers, because with, as I said, TIO, Caledon, and West Farmers all going into other insurers, well, that's three less clients for some reinsurance broker. I was speaking to one of the reinsurance brokers who actually would not be surprised if in the next 2 to 3 years of the big four brokers, Marsh, Aon, JLT, and Willis, that one of those has a worldwide merger. He says, it's not, there's always these conversations, but something will move along those lines. And what you're finding too, locally, is you're also finding the rise of what you would call the domestic broker groups, the Steadfast, the Aus brokers, who are have been quite aggressive in the last few years buying not only the broker agencies, but they've also been buying the underwriting agency. Steadfast this year just bought off of QBE, CHU, and UAA. So these are entities that probably a few years ago, you wouldn't have, maybe 5-6 years ago, you wouldn't have contemplated Steadfast spending $260 million to acquire an underwriting agency. So now they've grown, and they're not really showing, they're not showing that they're moving away from that growth strategy. They've recognized that, yeah, contribute. A number of, shall we say, the statistics I get on this from Deloitte has produced a series of reports called Building the Lucky Country, and they've done one on regulation, and I've pulled some of the statistics from this. And their report wasn't just insurance, it was Australia. And one of the interesting numbers was that all of Australian industry spends $94 billion dealing with government, complying with government regulation. The last government, the Rudd government, or regular Rudd government, introduced 21,000 regulations. Think about that. I mean, as a lawyer, yay. But not even the legal profession and everyone else can get across 21,000. There is now, if you were to take the rules and regulations, which is all regulations, all legislation, and kind of put it, it's 500,000 pages in Australia. The government doesn't even know, or they do not have a definitive list of all the different agencies and corporations and operations which they have. So you have this enormous regulatory environment, which, and if you compare it to 20 years ago, it's going like this. And as it stands now, there's nothing that indicates that it's actually going to level off. Regulation, at least government regulation, is increasing and will continue going forward. And what government tries to accomplish with regulation is they want certainty within the market. They want consistency. They want to improve the general well-being. And they want to reduce exposure. But is this all for the best? Because sometimes people look and say, well, you know, whenever you put in a regulation, you're trying to solve an ill or you're trying to solve a problem. Many times, sometimes, the problem that you're trying to solve by the creation of the regulation, you've now created another problem. Or it may just be that creating the regulation at all was not really necessary. It's, you know, human nature being what it is, for the last 100-150 years, we all managed to survive quite well without a regulation on our, you know, our food that told us, you know, don't stick too much of this in your mouth, you may choke. So what we need to do from regulation, at least going forward, and what would be better, is if we... government was able to identify what risks do we really need to regulate against. What is the purpose of regulation? Is it to micromanage everybody down to the final, you know, minutia? Or is it really, as I say, to create a consistent, certain environment? And in some respects, unfortunately, regulation isn't going that way. It would be great if it was, but... unfortunately, as I say, all it's doing is adding additional costs. It's signed that a lot of regulations at times reduces innovation. There's a view, and this is, I think, an insurance view, which I've heard from a number of different people, enunciate that with APRA regulations, there's a concern that, well, it's, you know, a principle-based regulation environment, that we're regulating people into a box, that we all want our insurers to all kind of operate with the same sort of range or the same sort of views on the market. And the issue with that is it's like the issue wherever you create a homogenous environment. If something comes along that can affect one, unfortunately you create an environment where it'll affect all of them. And would we be better with a regulatory environment where everybody was slightly, potentially different, so everybody could react slightly different to the impending impacts that, well, let's face it, they will come, and that will happen. The other phase of regulation that I don't think people think about as much is what we call private regulation, which is, it's the rise in the last 10 to 15 years of not only having the government regulate what you should do, but also the rise of the internal policy and procedure. We can take that $94 billion amount that we applied to government regulation, and when we tie in the cost of private regulation, Australia is now spending $250 billion a year in managing both private and public regulation. That's an astounding amount of money. Now, the motivation for most companies to do this is risk avoidance. I would say in some respects, there is a certain keeping up with the Joneses. There's a public relations aspect with some private regulation. There's the idea that everybody has this policy. We must have this policy. You wonder at times, and yet again this gets back to the idea of are people doing a cost-benefit analysis every time they look and introduce a new policy? And, you know, what is the actual cost of introducing this, and are we getting the benefit, or are we just putting a regulation out there? Yet again, you know, let's face it, I'm in the legal profession, and we're always very happy to write up policies and documents for you, and we're always very happy to look at them. But to some respect, there are, if there is no benefit to the policy, if there's no benefit to the document, then people need to start looking, what are we adding with these? One of the interesting stats from the Deloitte paper was industry-wide, in 1990, 5.8% of the Australian population was employed in compliance. Now there's 10% of the Australian population is employed in compliance, which is more than all the people employed in mining. Compliance is one of the biggest industries in this country. Now, if we take it to financial services and insurance, that number gets up to 20%. 20% of the workforce is just in compliance. That's an astounding number, and I suspect it's probably a number that going forward will reduce, because it's not viable to have that many people just ticking boxes and making sure everything is done. We had a talk before about technology, and I understand there's a session right after this, so I'm not going to talk about products or risks that much, other than though I will make one comment. I have a slightly different view on cyber insurance. I don't think it's going to be, I think how people market cyber insurance is wrong right now. I don't think they market it to big companies. I don't think it's a product for big companies. I think it's an SME product. Because big companies have their own IT departments, so why do they need someone to come in to save them when something goes bad? But, anyway, sorry. From a technology point of view, I think the one thing to keep in mind is not so much the product side, is I looked at it from the industry point of view. And there's a report out there that said one of the industries most at risk from technology is accounting. That in 20 years, the services with which accountants provide will plummet quite a bit. And insurance companies have a number of accountants and a number of bookkeepers in it. And you're going to find a lot of these people will be made redundant just because of technological innovation, in that one person will be able to calculate or do the data that maybe multiple people can do. Another reason is that some of the people will, as you indicate, will no longer be in Australia. They will be in India, they will be overseas. So your staffing needs will go down. And some of it is just the lack of professional oversight. Is you're not going to need it as much, or one person is going to be doing the sign-off rather than having multiple people. In addition, you're probably going to find that claims teams within most insurers are going to go down, because as the whole claims experience, more and more people will be able to do that on a self-assessment sort of view, fill in the claims form, go get his car, go to the dealer, or sorry, not the dealer, the auto shop, they'll say what it is, and you just plug in the code, and that's it. When we look at new risks, I think one of the new risks that you're going to be looking at is along privacy. I think that privacy is going to be an area in which there's going to be a huge increase in claims, and by that I mean the fact that if I was, you know, to suddenly fall down and start shaking, some of you would rush forward and save me, and then the other ones would get your camera out from your phones and start taking it and putting it on the internet. And I think that at some point, that sort of behavior is going to rise to all sorts of potential claims, you know, people being shown in environments that they never expected that would happen, you know, someone being identified at a zone or, you know, at a place, and then them losing their jobs. It's very quick now. The internet mob reacts quite quickly. People are very quick to get offended on social media and the internet, and, you know, there's a number of cases where people have been identified being in locations and then, or, you know, being part of events, and then their employer catches wind, you know, they're unemployed within 24 hours, whereas 10, 15 years ago, nobody would ever have known they were there. Or so there's those sort of risks. And I also think from an Australian point of view, there's going to be the expansion of the location of risks. I think it's been very common for an insurer to have a large Australian corporate to say, well, we're, you know, we'll insure all your risks. But as, you know, these Australian corporates have centers in India for their accounting, and they have call centers in the Philippines, I think insurers are going to have to start looking into what other markets they're going to have either relationships or underwriting capability so that they can, you know, effectively keep their clients. Because as we were talking about, you want to keep market share, you want to keep your clients close. You want to be able, when someone walks in and says, you know, we do business in Queensland and New South Wales, oh, by the way, we've got these operations overseas. Insurers want to be that one-stop shop. Or if they don't want to be, they should. Climate. I think it's, if you've been in the insurance industry, I think we've heard ad nauseum that climate change is here. There's an increased exposure to severe events is probably what is going to be one of the biggest impacts from climate change. 20 of the hottest years since 1850 have happened since 1990. 1977 was the last year that the year was colder than the average. So since that point, the temperatures have been going up. And one of the results of that is that, you know, you have to be careful. A lot of science that I've read on it say that they don't see that there's going to be more cyclones, there's going to be more earthquakes, but there is the view that some of the intensity of some of these windstorms will increase because of it. I was at a presentation a few months ago where the meteorologist for IAG raised a very interesting point. He said that this year, for the first time ever, the water off Sydney got half of the degree off of what would support a cyclone. So historically, Sydney really hasn't been a huge cyclone risk. But as water temperature rises, Sydney's suddenly going to come into the cyclone belt, as it was. And clearly, very few of the houses built in Sydney have been built with the idea that they should be able to withstand a cyclone. So hence, not only heightened risk in that there's risk going to be in a location that people probably previously hadn't thought about, but also construction within that area has never been around the idea that they would ever have to face those sorts of winds. And I say this coming from a guy who lives in a weatherboard house. So there's also, you know, there's the classic black swan events, which is, you know, the Newcastle earthquakes. That's just, nobody can predict it. One of the insurers told me the other day that they viewed when they were doing their stress testing, you know, their worst event, and they said that there was the worst event for them is a Melbourne earthquake, to which I kind of said, earthquake in Melbourne? And he said, well, you know, hopefully it will never happen. But that's what they figured would be their worst event. The second part of climate I want to talk about is what I would call the social climate. Hopefully nobody is out there trying to buy their first house in Sydney this week, because the housing market in Australia, Australia, but we'll just talk Sydney and the Eastern Seaboard, is going nuts. And one of the results of that is we're going to see increased density living. Sydney has very little in the way of apartments, condominiums generally, but going forward, that is how people are going to afford to buy housing in Sydney. So you're going to see an increase in the next 10 to 15 years of construction. If anybody has seen, you know, it was the old brewery site by the University of Sydney behind behind Central Station. I come over the Anzac Bridge every day, and I can see kind of the UTS tower and those towers, and then you can see kind of a gap, and then you get to kind of the CBD. Within the next 15, 20 years, that will, I'm predicting, that will be all towers. So when you have these events happen, it's going to not only affect single unit housing, you're going to be dealing with large units. And I think what the construction industry has shown in other countries when they deal in multi-unit buildings, they're really poor at building them. I come from Canada, which had a huge leaky condo issue. I understand New Zealand has a fairly large leaky condo issue, which is generally a cost that will fall on the insurance industry, not only in the event a storm happens, but also insuring all these builders who have done a poor job. I'm being told to wrap up. Then the other, so I'll talk about quickly, the other big risk is terrorism, the stability of the market. This was another presentation I saw, which was very chilling, that it would take someone at Central Station with approximately 5 liters of kind of gas, pump it into the air, and you pretty much will have coverage of the entire CBD with a gas attack. Now there's multiple clearly horrible issues with that, but from an insurance cost point of view, there's a view that, oh, well, you know, gas doesn't destroy buildings. But in actual fact, it will probably have a greater insurance impact because every single building in the CBD would have to have their heating and air conditioning systems completely flushed. And until that happens, those buildings wouldn't be safer and have damage. So if you think about a gas attack in that as the gas came in and it gets, you know, goes through the building, gets sucked through everybody's, all those buildings will have to have their systems flushed. They won't be habitable. What will that do for consequential and economic loss? Okay. Capital. People are going to talk about capital ad nauseum, I think, when they talk about this. I think the one point I wanted to make about capital is everybody talks about capital kind of in the sense that, you know, when that big event happens, you know, what size event will happen to, you know, reduce capital. I think people have to realize that capital markets are very efficient in that when I was still in Bermuda in 2005, in the Katrina year, it happened to wipe out a couple of reinsurers. The Bermuda market was able to raise $11 billion in capital, which probably isn't that much these days, but it was able to raise $11 billion to support 9 reinsurers, and they did that in 4 weeks. They did that effectively from about November 1st to December 1st. They established it. Now, so capital moves to where there's return fairly quickly. I think there, if reinsurance or if insurance continues to have low returns, well, the capital is probably just going to naturally move out of the market in any event. So some of the capital that is excess now isn't going to kind of go away because there's a massive windstorm or, you know, a Florida hurricane. It's just going to go because the markets will start pulling that capital out. So there will be some natural consolidation or leveling of the capital market just from economic returns. And I think I'm done.
So thank you very much.
It just shows how interesting it is to be a futurist. And we have gone a little bit over time. So we've got about time for about 3 or 4 questions, just to finish off the session. What I would encourage you to do is think about your questions in terms of flowing on to the extra sessions that we've got going forward. So what's the insightful questions that might open up our way of thinking about the future? And we can see one. There's a roving mic, so...
Thanks, Tim. Vicky Mullen from the Insurance Council. I've got a question. I think it might flow on to the rest of the day. The issue of stranded assets and the investments in fossil fuel assets and the recent statement by the Bank of England to the insurers over there. How are people reading what potential impact that might have here?
I'll throw it to Kevin on that one because it sounds a bit difficult. Kevin?
At the end of last year, the Bank of England issued a letter, I understand it was, to the insurers listed in that jurisdiction, asking them, I think if I'm correct, to start reporting on their exposures to what we would probably generally understand as stranded assets, that is, investments in fossil fuel assets technologies that might start to lose their value because of the investor community not wanting to be exposed to those assets anymore for environmental reasons.
So, and you're looking at kind of the moral hazard of owning these assets, insuring these assets when the value's plummeting against it. So, I'll still throw to Kevin, having clarified the question. I mean, within the environments I work, this is definitely a underwriting feature that you take into account. And I think it will become more and more prevalent. Moral hazard is something we've got to manage as an insurance industry wherever we work. And as technology and as processes change, as people's business models are forced to change, certain things become redundant. And if you're sitting on a redundant asset and insuring it, the moral hazard goes up. So it's a fundamental of insurance that no matter what changes in the future, managing moral hazard is one of our core skill sets.
Vicky, I can't add much to that. I'm not actually familiar in detail with the situation that you're describing. I know my company is one of the reinsurers who sets an enormous store in green values, and we're also very careful about our approach to underwriting for moral and ethical issues. From our own investment perspective, we take a very conservative approach to investments. So we would tend, for example, to back all of our technical liabilities with, generally speaking, government bond and other corporate fixed interest issues. So I suspect we don't have, through our investments, too much exposure to those issues. But in terms of the underlying side, I would have to defer to my colleagues. But I can try to get back to you, Vicky, on that if you like.
Can we take that one of those? Yeah. That and perhaps the Greek debt. I hope you're not investing in that. Elaine
Collins. My questions are much easier than that.
I'll answer it.
One comment and one question. I had a comment for Mark. I was so glad you raised the regulation issue, Mark, because I think it's so key that overregulation may stifle innovation, which actually introduces an even bigger risk than the regulation was trying to cover in the first place. So I think that circle is just really important to point out. And I realise too that prime ministers and governments pride themselves in the number of regulations they introduce. I remember when Julia Gillard was leaving, she kept saying how many pieces of regulation and legislation to introduce, and that was her contribution to Australia. So I think what I really want is I want a government to be voted in that's going to run the show better, not a government that's going to introduce more regulation. So I think they actually see their value to the voters as introducing new regulation, and that's almost where their value ends. So I think if governments can change that for us, I just think it should change. It shouldn't be how many pieces of regulation introduced. It should be how they run the show better.
How effective and how well we set up Australia to kind of react agilely to what the world's going to throw at us.
Exactly. Yeah, sorry, my question was for Kevin. It was very detailed, Kevin, but it was interesting your graph on GDP versus premium rate increases. And the graph just seemed to be completely opposite. Whenever GDP went up, premium rates decreased. Then when GDP went down. It just seemed that the two seemed to be so opposite. I'm not sure if there was a, is there a delay? Anyway, I know it was a very detailed question, but I thought premium rates would tend to go up when GDP went up because the economy was growing and everyone was doing well and they were insuring more things. But it just seemed to be the opposite, so I was interested in that. Thank you.
That's a good question. I think you're right, there is quite a bit of volatility over there, and given how closely
GDP and economic growth have tracked over the long term, I mean, within 0.3% of one another, you're right, there's a close relationship clearly between them, but not year by year. And I think there can tend to be a little bit of a lag at times, probably. So it looks like they're going in different directions, but I think it's the lag.
Okay. And we have time for one more question.
Dimitri Simonovic from AIG. And so a couple of topics that have been raised this morning were alternative reinsurance capital and the financial technology startups. What do you think if those two things come together? Do you have any thoughts on what the future might look like for the general insurance industry then?
Reinsurance industry and...
No, if the financial technology startup side is effectively able to leverage alternative...
Peer funding, if you like, for cat risk.
Well, not necessarily the cat risk, I mean, just broader securitization of insurance risk.
So I'll throw to John on this to start with.
Dimitri, I think in the longer term, FinDev is going to be absolutely extraordinary. I think for the time being, it's really hard to predict exactly where and how fintech is really going to impact. I think in relation to alternative risk transfer, I mean, Kevin already made some introductory remarks and alluded to some of the difficulties and some of the challenges. One of them I see, and it's clear that alternative risk transfer, as Kevin said, is making inroads, particularly to other markets. And the way in which that's clear to us in Australia is not so much that we've got direct competition from alternative risk transfer in Australia, but what we do see is that because ART in other markets is having an impact, that some of the conventional reinsurers who were expecting to place to write premium income in those other markets are coming looking to our market. So we're indirectly experiencing that competition. I think one of the challenges locally is on the regulatory front, because if you have a conventional natural catastrophe protection program, you might know that your retention is, let's say, $100 million, and that's kind of regardless because of the basis of the contract between yourself and your reinsurer. If ART, it's a difference between parametric and non-parametric covers, and it might be difficult to persuade the regulator as to what your insurance concentration risk charge should be if you have one of those alternative risk transfer covers. But in the long term, I wouldn't be confident to give an answer.
And in terms of the kind of insurance industry piece, I mean, you've got to think about what you, as an insurer, as an actuary advising insurers, is unique that can't be replicated by someone else. You know, is supply chain management something that's unique? Is understanding risk something that's unique? Is controlling moral hazard something that's unique? And you've got to find out which part that you have an intellectual property advantage over the smart guy sitting in Silicon Valley, out thinking lots of different thoughts and lots of smart things about how we could do it better. They want to do it before us. So, very challenging question. So, with that, I'd like to thank, I won't do the traditional wines, but can we put the hands together for the three presenters? I think it's excellent. Now, I think logistics, and David, are you running the next session? Ms. David, you're running the next session, so I'm going to give them an extra 5 minutes. So back at 11:05, a cup of tea and everything. Thank you very much.